Why is it we humans get romanced by complexity when the answers can be found at a simple and practical level? This is the Simply Practically Human podcast, where the human manager, Mark Labasque, features experts who have a track record in humanizing workplaces, using simplicity and practicality as their go-to approach. It's all about getting back to what it is to be human and watch workplaces thrive rather than just survive.
Hey there, it's Mark Labasque for the Simply Practically Human podcast. My guest for today is author, CEO and founder of Extraordinary Leadership, Gerard Penner. And I go a long way back with Gerard. My first time with Gerard was when he was coming into Australia Post when I was working there as a leadership consultant and taking us through some amazing work. And I dubbed him at the time what I call the human whisperer. He just had this innate ability to almost know what was going on for people before they knew it. And it was something that I was fascinated by. And over time, and in somewhat a little bit reluctantly, got me to reach out to him as I was looking at my next part of my own career, was to reach out to Gerard and just tap in a little bit around his own experiences. And one thing I'll say as I came out of that, even going in a little bit, I'll be scared and fearful of, looking at someone who I put on such a pedestal about how brilliant they were at this leadership stuff and if I would be able to get there. He was such a helpful person. He taught me some valuable lessons early days. He helped me in a lot of ways and he inspired me to get up and have a crack at what I do today. And we also spent a bit of time in the classroom in Harvard back in 2014 at the Art and Practice of Leadership Development around the Heifetz and Linsky work on adaptive leadership. And again, spending time with him there, getting to know him more, learning from him was great. And we've kept in touch over that time. And look, today, Gerard will talk a bit about his business, which is called Extraordinary Leadership, the book that he will be releasing in August, which I really encourage people to have a look at. He talks about the gift of COVID today. He'll talk a little bit about what we call the genius of and the importance of embracing both strength and warmth as the real qualities of leadership and maybe not looking at them at opposite ends of the continuum. I love when he talks about that leadership is really worked out in the laboratory of life, and he'll go into that in some more detail. It's been a fascinating conversation today. As I said, I'm a huge Gerard Penner fan, and I just love to listen to his ability to bring lived experience together with the research and the academia. He is a person who reads a hell of a lot, as you'll pick up as we go through some of the quotes that he shares. So sit back, have a listen. You're going to pick up some great tips and tools today to take back. He's got 8 tips and habits of great leadership in his book. He shares 2 or 3 of those today, which is great. Have a listen, see what you think, and we'll catch you at the end. I'm delighted to be joined today by good friend, CEO and founder of Extraordinary Leaders and author, Gerard Penner. Gerard, thanks for joining me, mate.
It's my absolute pleasure, Mark.
Mate, we go back a long way, and I think maybe longer than, maybe you will realise it, maybe you won't, but I always like to start with how we connected, but as the guest, I'll get you to go first. Maybe your first impressions of when we connected, and then maybe how have we sort of kept connected?
Yeah, well, I knew your name because you were working at Australia Post and I'd been involved in running a bunch of leadership training programs and leadership assessments. You'd worked closely with a couple of people that I knew pretty well. And you reached out to me at a point which was about maybe a year before we then went to a Harvard program together. And you reached out to me to say good day and to connect. And I remember sitting with you in a coffee shop. And this is a really clear impression for me, this sort of impression of very outgoing, friendly, open, authentic, kind of vulnerable guy. You're really very clear about what you wanted to achieve, what you were trying to do, and sort of this making this really key transition in your life. And you were very openly reaching out to make connections. And also I got this sense of seeking help, seeking support. And I thought that's incredible because a lot of guys aren't good at doing that.
Yeah, no, thank you, mate. I remember that coffee shop and I think it might've been, It might have been Dennis Attacador that was getting in my ear about one of my ex-colleagues at Post getting in my ear about meeting you. But I remember you being in those training rooms at Aussie Post, and I clearly remember saying, geez, I wish that was me at the front of the room. And again, if my impressions of you, like you just, I do refer to you at times as the human whisperer. You have this innate, unique ability to, I think, very, very quickly pick up on what's going on for people in the room, even when they can't. And I was just watching the way you were engaging and interacting with the group and thinking to myself, I'd like to be like him one day.
Well, you obviously don't live in my shoes to really understand what the authentic experience is like.
So look, one of the things that I'm really excited about is you've got the launch of your book as the author now for August this year. Let's just talk a little bit about that now, if you wouldn't mind, the process that you've been through there, and you know how it's feeling to know that in August your message is going out to the world about extraordinary leadership.
Great question. You'll know the experience of having a vision for yourself or finding a purpose, but feeling like you're not completely living it, that you haven't yet brought your life into alignment with that vision for yourself. And I had that experience over the last few years. I was running a lot of leadership programs, doing a lot of coaching, but felt that my ability to help people was constrained by the fact that there was just me, and a lot of my work was sort of face-to-face in front of training rooms or in executive coaching sessions. And a number of people had said to me over a period of time, you need to write a book, you need to write a book. But I hadn't yet found the motivation to do it. And as you know, writing a book is a huge effort. You're really putting yourself out there. It takes a lot of discipline and there's a lot of false starts in the process. And what happened, I'd made a commitment to write the book last year, and then COVID hit. And COVID was extraordinary because it presented a huge number of challenges for a lot of us.
Yeah.
In many ways, though, I also hold the idea that it presented a gift. There were gifts there for us if we were prepared to notice them. And one of the gifts for me was that it removed the ego distractions of constantly saying yes to people to run programs and do things because I felt wanted, and it allowed me to focus on writing the book that I needed to write so that I could actually be helpful to more people. I can hopefully help more leaders through this book than I can purely on a one-to-one basis.
Relating very much to what you said there around, I was given some advice by a friend in New York who said, COVID is a gift, but you're not seeing it that way, Mark, because you just love being in the room because you've got a massive ego. And so I can really relate to what you've just said there. And the other thing I just want to pick up on quickly here, because I know you are extremely helpful as a person. Like you talked then about being helpful for more leaders in the world by writing this book. How important is helpfulness as a leadership quality, do you think?
I think the very best leadership, and I obviously have to respond to this based on my own personal experience of what I've had to find in myself to be able to show up most usefully as a leader to others with the more effective, catalyzing, energizing, mobilizing, influencing, helpful leadership. And for me, it is of being service. And whenever I look, no matter where I look at the leaders who go beyond ordinary to extraordinary, it is that their leadership is in service of something and it's greater than themselves. It has to be greater than themselves because when you're serving yourself, you're serving a small version of I. When you serve others, when you serve a purpose in the world, and it might be to help others, it might be to help the communities, it might be to help the world, your leadership can amplify because it's fueled by something and it's no longer being constrained by the limits of ego.
Yeah, I love it. Obviously, I talk regularly to people about things like helpfulness and thankfulness and fun and these sorts of things, which are usually not words that we associate with leadership, but I actually think, Jared, that we're starting to hear more of those words being used. And I've been fortunate. You've actually sent me a little bit of the new book, which I was excited to receive and to read some of it. And some of the things that I was picking up pretty early is how much you're tying it to like our human qualities and that human hardwiring that we had. And it's, I can't wait to get my hands on the total copy. Let's dig back a bit into your past for a good reason that I love the listeners to know the human being. Before we sort of get into the into the work stuff. So give us a bit of a backstory, mate, where you grew up and some of maybe the early influences on you that around leadership and understanding it and sort of how you've ended up where you are today.
Yeah, I'm like you, Mark. I like to know the person and what their hopes and dreams and aspirations are and what's shaped them in life so that I can connect to that. The person that is Jared Penner today has been influenced by a lot of things. Those childhood experiences were quite formative. I grew up in Ferntree Gully, which is at the foothills of the Dandenongs. I describe it as a working class suburb. And we had a lot of, you know, traditional Australian Anglo-Saxon families in the area, but there was a lot of migrants as well. In fact, my parents were both migrants, my mother Dutch and my father Italian. And that actually defined my primary school years quite significantly. I don't have fond memories of primary school, at least in the playground. I was small. I was socially inept. I was shy. I was younger than everyone else. And I didn't fit either of the major, kind of the two big in groups. You were either a skippy or you're a wog.
Yep.
And I kind of didn't fit either of those. I think someone described me as a clogwog because I was half Dutch, half Italian. But it meant that I didn't fit into either group. And because I didn't have sporting ability, which, you know, is kind of important piece of capital in the playground politics, and I wasn't funny, I wasn't kind of the comic, I was often on the outside and I felt excluded a lot. What it meant is I became quite an acute watcher of other people and always asking myself the question, why do people do these things to each other? Why do we behave the way that we do? Because human beings are capable of such wonderful, glorious, generous, transcendent behavior. But at the same time, we're capable of some pretty ordinary, self-serving, abusive, diminishing behavior. And that curiosity about what drives those two different things and how can we have more of the former and less of the latter has been a big signature in my life. It actually then translated into my first field of study, which was education. I studied to be a teacher because I wanted to create a better experience for children than the one that I'd had.
Yeah. I always like to find commonalities and connections. I spent my first 8 years in Bayswater. I think we're reasonably close around age as well. I'm 54.
We are.
Yeah. So, you know, not too far from Ferntree Gully at the time. And that sort of that interesting thing around fitting in, you find those connections. I think this is part of that good part that you talk about with humans is if we just spent more time talking to each other, connecting, communicating, and then understanding, I think this would lead to a lot more of that leadership that you're going to talk about. And the other thing is teaching, mate. Did you study teaching?
Yeah, at what's now Deakin.
Yeah.
Used to be Burwood.
Yeah, and I was at Ballarat. Most likely around the same sort of time as you. When did you do, when were you going through the teacher's college?
So I started in 85.
Tick, same thing again, mate. Started in 85, finished in 87. And look, it's really interesting. I think there's no secret to the fact that we're both still in this space because I have very, very fond memories of the delight that to 5 to 12-year-old kids, which was the kids that I was teaching, just watching them learn. And I still get that same delight, which I'm sure you do, out of, I call it the 55-year-olds now, who I still have the ability to learn and know more about self in order to, you know, as you said, serve others.
Indeed. I think about that a lot, about what are the moments in the work that I do that activate me, that galvanize me, motivate me, and I find rewarding. And it's exactly the same thing that I saw in the kids, and that is that it's that moment of discovery of something, you know, where they see something for the first time they hadn't seen before, or they start to know or recognize something or be able to do something that they couldn't before. It's a incredibly rewarding moment to be able to see that. I mean, it's actually part of the reason why I also struggled with the idea ultimately of becoming a teacher is that a lot of what goes on in schools today is not in service of that moment of discovery. It's about, you know, codifying and creating a compliant, industrialized process that kind of just locks kids into something. And we saw this, and you see this in organizations too. You know, I'm much more interested in helping leaders break out of limiting paradigms or beliefs or behaviors than I am in helping them conspire to perpetuate some kind of status quo, which actually holds us all in some psychological, spiritual prison.
Mate, you have just done me the most amazing favour, because I was going to go somewhere with a question without notice, which you've just opened up the box to in a very, very big way. You talk a lot about, looking at your website, you talk a lot about, you know, going from average to extraordinary. And I have a view of the education system that it is about creating average, that it's about getting people to, you know, there'll be some gifted ones and there'll be some ones that fall out the bottom, but you know what, if we can just get them to average, but then we send them into the high school and then we send them into university. And then, as you said, we then go into the workplace. I'd be interested to get you to talk a little bit about, how do we break this cycle? How do we break this cycle that it's about getting people to, let's say, if we can get them to 51%, we've got them over the line. Have you got any thoughts around that?
Well, I think the first thing has to start with recognition of where we're really at the moment, accepting that we have a problem, because we do have a problem. And the question is, how big is the problem? So let's examine that. The first thing, the trust in our leaders is low. And you just got to look at the Edelman Trust Barometer data around that. And in fact, I think even in the most recent spring update, you know, trust in our national leaders had plummeted. We've got a problem with leadership quality. DDI do every year and a half to 2 years, they do a leadership forecast. It involves thousands and thousands of people around the world where they survey them around leadership. In their latest report, the HR professionals who responded in that survey, less than one quarter of those HR professionals said that they had high quality leadership. Now, that means that 75% of the 1,743 organizations that were included in that survey have average, poor, or ordinary leadership. Thomas Chamorro Premusic, who is a professor of psychology at University College London and Columbia University, his research suggests that up to half of our leaders are not sufficiently competent to do their roles. Now, and that's not just Thomas talking about it. Bill Gentry, who a lot of people know through his work at the Center for Creative Leadership, has had numerous studies showing that ineffective leaders make up half the management pool. You know, and then the question, so it's, what does that lead to? Well, what it leads to is quite an unsatisfying work experience for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Gallup, one piece of research they did, 142 countries covered in this research, they found that only 13% of employees were highly engaged and 34% were highly disengaged. Now, that's rather problematic when what all of us want is to be able to come to work and feel like we are doing something that is valuable and that the work that we are doing has meaning and that we are living an important, significant part of our lives in a satisfying way. And here's the biggest issue I see at the moment, Mark, and that is that, you know, there's an enormous amount of disruption and change going on in the world, and we are having to adapt and innovate our teams, our organizations, our institutions, and our communities, if we want to thrive,
yeah,
not just survive. Yet you look at the McKinsey data, and that says that 70% of transformation efforts fail. And when you look, dig into it, the role of leadership is quite central to that. So, you know, if we want to be engaged and fulfilled, and if we need to transform our world, the evidence is simply that we need more extraordinary leaders.
Yeah. Love the data that you shared there. As you were talking there, Jared, I was thinking about the archaic system, the 100-year-old system that promotes technical competence into people management roles without even asking a simple question that I think, which is, why do we not ask human beings if they would like to choose the pathway of stepping into being in charge of other human beings, in essence, stepping into some sort of leadership, even though you don't need to be in charge of humans to lead? Your thoughts around how do we, again, address this issue that I think is still there, is that the best salesperson becomes the next sales manager and we set them up in some respects to fail because they keep selling and they don't get above that and start to, you know, as the Heifetz and Linsky talk about, get up on the balcony and start to look in and look at themselves, look at others. What are your thoughts around how we can address that one?
It's a great question. It's one that I'm hopeful that is addressed in the book, in that what we tend to do is, in Western societies, we value what we'll call it strength. We value an individual's agency. We value their ability to be competent and exercise their will on the world and ultimately get things done. I mean, that's why individual contributors are recognized, because they're good at getting things done. They start to develop expertise, they develop mastery and competence, and they use their initiative and they're proactive. So they're exerting their will on the world, and we promote them for that reason. But that's largely an individual effort. It's largely an individual act. It's about I. Leadership at its best, in fact, for even leadership to be effective, has to engage and mobilize and connect with other people. And that means that there's this other attribute which is required, which is different to strength, which is warmth. You know, warmth is our ability to make sense of the world and respond to it with and through other people. And it involves connectedness and it involves trust and it involves openness. And we promote people on strength, yet one of the most important attributes when you get into a leadership role is warmth.
Yeah.
And then here's the thing that we do really badly. Because we don't pay attention to warmth, and even when we do, we tend to treat strength and warmth as opposites. We tend to treat them as two things that sit at the opposite ends of a continuum, and that to have more of one, you've got to have less of the other. And so you get leaders going through these oscillations, these kind of massive swings between getting things done, and then they get this feedback, well, you're just focused on getting things done and you're not focused on people. So they go, right, I'll let go of getting things done and I'll focus on people. And they start to focus on people and they're having, you know, conversations with them, small talk, but things aren't getting done and they start to get really frustrated by it. And after a while, they snap back to the other end and they go through this massive oscillation. We don't teach people the genius of and.
Mm.
We don't teach our leaders how to bring those two things together, to merge them and blend them in their leadership, the way in which, you know, yin and yang are necessary. They're not opposites. They actually, when they come together, there's an alchemy that produces something quite extraordinary.
The oscillation really, you know, resonates strongly with me. And I'm really excited because of what you've just talked about. And obviously those things are going to be in the book coming out in August. This idea that strength and warmth can coexist, that it's not about, hey, you've got to be a hard ass, Mark. And then, oh, things aren't working. Your people are disengaged because of the survey we got. Now we need to teach you how to be more of a human being. We'll whack you off to a 2-day course and come back from that and you should be okay. And this is a lifelong challenge. It's like we don't make it to the end with this stuff. And I think we spend a lot of time trying to measure that with people and we'll get you to a certain standard and then you'll be okay. And I really love that these things, this idea of the genius of and, because, you know, the either or stuff,
yeah,
doesn't really cut it. I reckon you picked up some things. I have a question here about how you define leadership.
Yes.
And I reckon I picked a few things up there, but maybe just let's play around with that for a moment. How do you define it? Because it's a huge thing.
Yeah. There's two parts to it for me. In fact, when you asked that question, it made me think of that moment in the lecture halls of Harvard, and you may have picked this up at the time, where Marty Linsky said one of the problems with leadership is it's poorly defined. And that is true. There's many, many different definitions of leadership. So I go to Rear Admiral Grace Murray Hopper. You may have heard of her before. She's actually famous for a few things. One, she was one of the earliest, I think, may have been the first woman in the US military to achieve flag status,
yep.
So a Rear Admiral. She also developed the computer programming code of COBOL. And then the third thing was that she was responsible for coining the term, there's a bug in the system, which actually involved the fact that they had a computer that overnight stopped working. And when they opened up the cabinet for the computer, a whole bunch of moths came out. But the thing that she said that has stuck with me is, we manage things and we lead people. We manage things and we lead people. And that was really important for me because it makes that clear distinction that there's two different types of work here and leadership involves people.
Yeah.
Then the question is, well, what is it that we do with people? Now, I've had to read, and some of them I've actually enjoyed, hundreds of peer-reviewed studies of leadership. And these are all academic studies and you have to, as a matter of process, define what you mean by leadership. And the consensus is, from all of those definitions, that leadership is about influence. And I agree with that. In my experience, leadership is about connecting, engaging, influencing, and mobilizing people for us to do what matters,
yeah,
towards the things that we care about.
And I remember those. I remember many things Marty said at Harvard, and I think one of the ones that stuck with me, maybe him or Ron said it, was that leadership was about disappointing people at a rate they could absorb.
Yes.
and even thinking about that, that's influence. That's influencing. I love that idea of we manage things and that we lead people. And it doesn't mean that, again, they can't coexist. I think that's important. The gap today between, let's call it, ordinary and extraordinary leadership, some people may see that it's a bridge too far. My sense of it is that it's not necessarily a bridge too far. It's just work that we don't do because we're off doing the other stuff that's easier for us.
Yeah.
How do you bridge that gap between ordinary and extraordinary? What would be some things that you've discovered as you've gone through your career in doing leadership programs and working with some very, very large organizations, but also as you were, you know, researching for your book, what are some of the key things that come to mind for you?
Mm. The first one, and I was talking about it before, was the genius of and. And what that involves is letting go of binary thinking. Most of us have a tendency towards binary thinking, and binary thinking is fantastic. I mean, it keeps us safe in the world. It's based on the premise that, you know, we can pretty quickly see something and we can decide, you know, it's one of two things. It's either good or it's bad. It's desirable or it's undesirable. So binary thinking is a really important survival thinking because it happens instantaneously and it happens really quickly. But binary thinking is also behind our tendency to treat strength and warmth as being two things that sit on opposite ends of a scale, or if they were on a seesaw, to have more of one, you have to have less of the other. And I've got a number of hypotheses about why that is. But for different people, it's going to be different things. For me, I think it came from my upbringing in this traditional Western upbringing in which men are strong and women are warm.
Yeah.
And because for the most part, at least up until recently, we haven't seen gender as being anything other than binary. You learn this as a kid. You're either a boy or a girl. I'm a boy, you're a girl. When in fact, we know it's much more nuanced than that. There are many, many different genders or sort of positions on some sort of continuum around gender, many combinations. But that's not what I had when I grew up. So I learned you're either a boy and therefore you become a man and therefore you're strong, or you're a woman and therefore you are going to be warm. And the moment we can let go of binary thinking and understand where the origins of our binary thinking around strength and warmth come from, we can then start to break through, because we start to then be able to embrace a version of ourselves and a version of living and a version of leadership that is authored well beyond where we currently are and is going to be hell of a lot more helpful to our relationships, to our lives, and to our teams and to our communities. So that's kind of that's the big one for me.
Yeah.
Understand the limitations of binary thinking around strength and warmth, do the work on yourself, and then start to embrace the one of those two things which isn't part of your normal way of being in the world. I mean, there's some really practical things and we do in the book. We cover the 8 habits of extraordinary leaders. And I'd be really happy to share a couple of those if you think that would be helpful.
Please do, mate, because I don't want you to give it all away, because we want people to get the book as well. But I think this sort of leads us into the real simple, practical tips that you can give now. So please give us 3 things that please share.
Here's a couple. So one of them is this idea of be intentional. Most of us are not aware of the fact that we have, at any given moment, we may be subject to competing intentions. And that's a function of the fact that we've got 2 different parts to our brain. We've got a part of our brain which is just really interested in survival. It's scanning for threats and it just wants to keep us safe. And there's part of our brain, the front modern part of our brain, which is capable of taking risks and stepping bravely and courageously into new territory. And I had an experience a couple of years ago that really brought this to light for me. I had enrolled in a 3-day program around keynote speaking. I really wanted to lift my skills in this space. There's about 30 people in the room, really capable professionals, a lot of expertise in the room, a lot of experience in the room, really solid crew. And I'd gone to that workshop with the intention of learning, to expand my capacity and to grow. But nonetheless, I found myself in that morning, in the first hour or two, there was this little knot in my stomach. And I've come to know that when I get a little bit of tightness in my stomach, that's usually in my gut, that's a sign that there's some kind of safety risk management thing going on in my system. You know, it's preparing my body for fight, flight, freeze. And I started to engage in a bit of inquiry, self-inquiry around it. And what I realized was that I actually was subject to competing intentions.
Yeah.
So part of me wanted to actually be seen as an expert in the room. It wanted me to be seen as competent. I mean, I have high needs around competence. It's actually part of my programming from childhood. It's actually how I got my love and my validation and my approval. So I know that that's a kind of that's written there. And nonetheless, I had this competing intention, which was to learn and to grow. So, I mean, they're two very, very different positions. One is to actually have all the answers. The other is to say, I only have questions.
Yeah, yep.
And in that moment, in recognizing those competing intentions, I was able to choose. Now, when we spend time with other people, there's times where we have competing intentions. We have an intention that is self-serving, and we may have an intention that is to genuinely connect and serve others. And to acknowledge that in the moment, ideally before you walk into a room, because your intentions walk into the room before you do.
Yeah, yep.
So to acknowledge those intentions, acknowledge them to yourself, and then you get to choose. And even if you've got those competing intentions, when you go into a conversation with someone else and you know they're still there, declare them to the other person, because then they can help you.
Yeah.
And then they can understand why you may seem a little bit conflicted and why you may seem not necessarily fully 100% clear about what you're trying to achieve. Because the truth is, other people are brilliant mind readers. By the age of 4, they've developed the capacity to read another person's mind and attribute intentions to their behavior. Mm. They'll already know you're conflicted.
I like that. Okay, there's one. What else? What other tip would you give out of the book?
The second would be, and this is a big one, is that when you bring strength and warmth together, it's an alchemy in and of itself. What it produces in leadership is what I call catalyst leadership. And catalyst leadership, if you remember high school chemistry, is, you know, a catalyst releases energy. It creates a transformation in other materials without itself being consumed in the process. And that seems really important to me in leadership today, particularly because it's so easy to get burnt out. And I know, Mark, you actually even sent something out this morning around self-care.
Mm.
To be a catalyst means that you have to release energy of others. When I mean releasing their energy, it's releasing their energy, releasing their potential, releasing their contribution, releasing their commitment for what matters. And to do that, you have to start connecting to what's in it for them, not what's in it for me. Now, you've probably heard the term with them over and over.
Yes.
And over. And
yep.
That's what most leaders tend to do. They tend to try and mobilize other people based on what motivates them and what's in it for them as the leader, without thinking really carefully, well, what would be in it for this person to want to engage in this purpose or to do this thing or to step into something courageously? And that kind of, for me, is really simple. If you don't know the hopes, dreams, and aspirations of other people that pull them forward, or if you don't know the fears, the anxieties, or the concerns that hold them back, you are powerless to lead them well. All that you're left with is the exercise of authority to tell them what to do and hope that they will comply.
Which means you've got to talk to them.
Yeah.
And that, you know, again, this could sound very, very simple, but what you said then, hopes, dreams, fears, concerns, great conversations to be having with people, not yeah. just other conversations that are important, like this is what we expect, here's your numbers, whatever it might yeah. be, but adding in that warmth piece here, and I'm going to also use another word here, the curiosity
yes.
to understand is just, I think, a critical aspect of leadership. There's some incredible tips there. Let me ask you this question. This is one without notice. What do you do to continue to develop yourself as an extraordinary leader? Because you are very, very good at what you do. You're an expert in what you do. And I love how vulnerable you are too, because I'm sure you walk into rooms like I do sometimes thinking, uh-oh, there'll be someone in here that's going to find me out today. What are the experiments that Jared runs to continue to not just teach but practice extraordinary leadership?
Mm. I tend to use life as my laboratory for doing this work. I don't think that leadership and living are disconnected from each other. I think they're inextricably intertwined. And it's kind of the three L's, life and leadership and learning.
Yep.
And they're all in service of each other. One of the things that I try to hold dearly is this idea that you should never believe your own bullshit. The moment I start to believe my own bullshit is that then I'm at risk of thinking I've got all the answers and I've got it all sorted, and I don't. And that's a really dangerous place to be as a leader. It's a dangerous place to be as a parent. It's a very dangerous place to be as a partner to somebody in life.
Mm.
You know, if you aren't constantly, you know, asking yourself the question, what's my role in the mess? And then working out, well, what contributed to that and what learning do I need to do or what experiments do I need to run? So for me, it's really simple that to make progress with life, for me to become more content, more satisfied, more happy, the job's not to look outside of myself to find the answer. The job is to look inside of myself to find the answer. And that for me is enough to galvanize a lot of stuff. Practically, what does that mean? It means I read a hell of a lot of stuff. I read a lot of books. I listen to podcasts. I've got right at the moment, I have my own coach because I'm sort of working on some stuff that I couldn't make progress with on my own. I use my relationship with Tams and our marriage as an incredibly important part of my growth and development. And I'm constantly asking myself, what is it I'm learning in this relationship which is relevant to life and more broadly and to leadership? And when people say to me, what's the best course you've ever been on? I say, I chose to get married with a deep commitment to stay married.
Yep.
Because you can't walk out, you can't run away from the stuff, and it keeps confronting you every single day.
I love it. Brilliant, mate. Thanks. What an amazing share. And so much resonates with me around, you know, the laboratory of life. And how you then can combine, which I'm sure you do because you're an avid reader, combining lived experience with some research and academia is, again, a bit of that, the genius of and rather than one or the other, which is a trap I've been caught in at times. It's like, stuff the academics, I'll just work it out through life. It doesn't always go all that well. Hey, I've got a little knot in my gut right now because I'm going to step into this thing around simplicity and complexity. And you know, my very, very basic view is that we overcomplicate or we look for complexity rather than step into perhaps just some of the simple things that you've talked about, talking to people, some of this stuff. What are your thoughts around why, if you do think this, why do humans at times want to get romanced by the flame of complex or complicated rather than maybe just simply having a conversation with somebody, as an example?
Now, I have to ask you, mate, when you talked about having a knot in your gut, What's the knot in the gut?
Because I still have this thing about you, the human whisperer, that I've been in the room with you as a student and then I started to get to know you and I watched you at Harvard, and then there's always this thing of, and I called you, I sent you a note saying about the Yoda-like qualities that you have. And sometimes I sort of sit there and think, one day these guys just going to tell me, I've got no idea what I'm talking about. So, or he's going to disagree with me and it's going to just knock me down. So I'm worried that I won't be good enough or accepting enough of the great G Penner at some point in time.
Golly. Yeah, the idea of being something like Yoda, green and wrinkled, but obviously a very joyful character. So, it's a great question. It's a fantastic question. And I'm really pleased that you asked that question, because what it does is it allows us to examine. And I think there is a tendency that people have to move towards making things complex and reinventing things that don't need reinventing. I mean, I always think about people going into jobs for the first time. You're promoted into a role. I don't know anyone who's ever gone into a new role and said, I'm going to do exactly what the person before me did, and I'm going to do it exactly the same way that they did it, and I'm not going to try and change anything because it was perfect. We all want to kind of reinvent things, don't we?
Yep.
We want to build things. I think that it is helpful to make a distinction between the times that it's helpful to move away from simplicity and the times when it's not where we should be embracing simplicity. So I'm not going to go, you know, binary, it's good or bad. I'm going to say sometimes it's good and sometimes it's bad. So the first, when might simplicity be unhelpful? And the question is, what if the simple answer is not sufficient to meet the complexity of the moment? You know, what if the practical, tried and tested answer isn't working? What if our normal, simple recipe for responding doesn't change anything? Because you know as well as I do that there are some problems and challenges for which there is no simple, easy answer. And whether you call them wicked problems or adaptive challenges, they are messier and more complex in nature. And we need to be prepared to develop some complexity in our thinking and leading if we're to succeed. Now, I know you know Bob Keegan and Lisa Leahy well.
Yeah.
And you know their work on adult development. So I could probably do nothing better to repeat what Bob and Lisa said in their book, In Over Our Heads, that when we experience the world as too complex, we are not just experiencing the complexity of the world, we're actually experiencing a mismatch between the world's complexity and our own at this moment.
Yeah.
And there's only two logical ways to mend this mismatch. We've reduced the world's complexity or we increase our own. So we go beyond simple, convenient, but unhelpful beliefs to develop some complexity in our thinking. Now, so that covers the when might it be helpful to move away from simplicity. But there are certainly times where it is very helpful to keep it simple. I know that there's a couple of reasons why I'm guilty of making things complicated. The ego needs are a big part of that. Sometimes to make ourselves, you know, particularly if we've got an identity which is based on expertise or knowing things, you know, to make ourselves stand out or to have something new to offer in a very crowded marketplace that's full of new knowledge, or even sometimes just to look smart. And I think the second time or reason why I move towards complexity when it's not helpful is because when I can move towards complicated and just, for example, expand knowledge and acquire new facts, et cetera, it creates the illusion that I'm learning and growing by generating more complex knowledge rather than the hard work of living by fewer simple wisdoms.
Yeah.
And, you know, Samuel Johnson, the 18th century English author, who said people need to be reminded more often than they need to be instructed.
Yeah.
And simplicity is hard because it forces you to keep coming back to some central self-evident truths over and over and confront the fact that you're not doing that thing that you said that you already do or that you were going to do.
Mate, I love it. I like the way you've covered all sort of aspects there. And I've not thought of that before, but the reinventing of things. I think there's a really, really strong lesson for listeners here around if you are going into a new role, or even if you're in a role now, just step back for a minute and go, do I have to reinvent things and what's really going on for me? And perhaps that is my status and my identity and my ego getting in there to say that I've heard lots of people say this is absolutely wrong the way they're doing it and I'm going to totally change it, but I've never heard someone go, this is fantastic and I'm just going to maybe bring some of my uniqueness to it but not going to change it too much. All righty, it got through that okay. The knot in my tummy has disappeared. Hey, I want to finish up with the book and also because I've been looking at your stuff. You're putting some great stuff out to the world now around your programs that you're running, the coaching that you're doing. The book is exciting. Where do people find more out about Extraordinary Leadership and how they can connect with you?
Yeah, well, probably the easiest thing to do is to go to the website, which is extraordinaryleaders.com.au, and that's extraordinary without an E at the front, so it just starts with X. And there's plenty of information there about, you know, some of the things that we believe and the programs that we run. There's also, I think we've just launched today, a white paper on the triumph. It's called The Triumph of Strength and Warmth, which is a cracking shorter read than reading the book. It doesn't necessarily teach you how to do it, but it certainly helps kind of make the case for why strength and warmth is the golden thread through all remarkable leadership. I've just started weekly blogging. I have to admit, I haven't been a consistent blogger in the past, but I've just started and built a real discipline around that. So you'll actually find on Medium and both LinkedIn, we're doing our own podcast around extraordinary leaders, which you'll have to come as a guest on my podcast in the not too distant future, Mark, where we really just want to examine, talk to extraordinary leaders themselves or global experts, share hints and tips about how to move towards extraordinary in our leadership. And of course, you can find me on all the normal sort of social media channels. I'm kind of posting pretty regularly now. Or simply, if you just want to have a chat, shoot me an email. It's jared@extraordinaryleaders.com.au.
Mate, I love that. I love that last piece. So I know when Marty was on here, Marty Linsky, he said, if you want to connect with me, just send me an email and I'd love to have a conversation. Sometimes people who might be listening to this would be like, oh, I'd love to speak to Jared, but oh, Jared's this. But what a great invitation. What a great show of warmth as well to go, send me an email. Let's arrange a conversation. Hey, mate, look, thanks for coming on. It's been far too long since we had our last conversation, and I'm really, really excited for what's coming up for you with the book launch. I can't wait to read it, and it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the Simply Practically Human podcast today. Cheers, mate.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's been an absolute privilege. I'm very grateful for the opportunity.
One thing I do know, and I'm sure many people feel this, it's just that there are certain individuals in the world that when you get the opportunity and the privilege to spend 45 minutes to an hour with them, you come away a much better person. And I know that in the podcast, Jared talked about this idea about helping to release the energy of others is a great quality of leadership. And it's something that he is a master at. And I feel totally energized after an hour of conversation with someone I consider to be not only a good friend now, but someone who is a teacher and someone who has taught me a lot over the last 7 years. Some of his shares today, really, this idea of the genius of and, rather than either or, and even though being binary at times is really important for us as a survival species, as he pointed out, our ability to sit with strength and warmth as key qualities of leadership and the way for us to take our leadership from ordinary to extraordinary leadership. Some of his shares around this idea that when we go into a new role, that we have some reason to have to think we have to reinvent things rather than simply stepping in there and doing, maybe continuing the good work that's been done and how that's attached to our identity and to our reputation and perhaps all to that big thing, our ego. This idea that life is his laboratory, as in when he thinks about leadership and the way that he is learning and learning to become an extraordinary leader as he continues his journey, which, as he says, started back in the primary school yard with just this, again, this ability that he's built to be able to just sit there and watch people and be curious as to why people were the way that they were. And this is the thing that he brings to his work today. These tips about being intentional, being that catalyst and helping other people to release that energy. And the one that I really, really loved was this idea of understanding the hopes and the dreams and the fears and the concerns of the people. Because if you don't know that, you truly cannot be seen as an extraordinary leader. And, you know, that comes back to what we did today, having conversations, getting curious, understanding each other. And some of these things that perhaps come out of that idea of warmth that seems to come second to this idea that strength is the way that leaders get the job done. I really enjoyed this conversation. And if you did, why not rate it 5 stars? And if you liked it as well, share it with your friends. But until next time, keep it simple, keep it practical, and keep it human. Bye for now.